Well, as I guess most of you know, in the past few weeks, in fact, the past week, we started a new Christianity Explored course. And in the first week of Christianity Explored, the first question, or one of the first questions you ask, is if you could ask God one question and you knew it would be answered, what would it be? Now, I've been writing down the questions that people have given on every course that I've done, and over the years, you start to see a bit of a pattern. By far, the most asked question ultimately boils down to, why doesn't God do something about suffering? Sometimes that's a general question. It might be, you know, something they've heard as maybe an argument against Christianity. More commonly, it's a particular question. Why did my family member die? Why is it that I'm going through this time of challenge? Why did a certain disaster happen this week on the other side of the world? I suspect most Christians would want answers to that kind of question as well. The fact is that suffering is a huge part of our lives, and quite frequently it doesn't seem obvious what God is doing in the midst of it. Which is why today we must ask how God's sovereignty, his control over all the events of human history, relates to our suffering. Is God really in control? There are five things we're going to discuss tonight that will sort of structure our time this evening. We're going to consider, first of all, the source of suffering. Where does suffering come from? Secondly, we're going to think about the problem of suffering, particularly why it's a challenge for us as Christians. Thirdly, we're going to consider the purpose of suffering, what God is doing in the midst of suffering. Fourthly, we'll consider the sympathizer of our sufferings, how Jesus gives us hope in the midst of what we go through. And then finally, we'll consider the end of suffering, what we have to look forward to when Jesus returns. So we're going to start by looking at the source of our suffering. And if you've got a Bible, why don't you turn to Romans chapter 8. What is the source of our suffering? As you turn there, you might think about how this relates to what we've considered in recent weeks. It's a good question. Where does suffering come from? 2 weeks ago, we thought about how God created a beautiful world. And that makes sense of why there's happiness and beauty in the world. Why so often good comes out in all areas of life. And then last week, we considered sin. Since human beings are sinful, it makes sense that suffering as a result of sin happens. But what about earthquakes causing houses to collapse with children inside? What about viruses killing millions of children? What about famines that are raging across sub-Saharan Africa at this moment in time? Why does God cause such things to happen? Well, the answer really comes in Romans 8, verse 18 to verse 20. I consider, this is Paul speaking, that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed to us. For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope. The creation was subjected to frustration. That's really Paul's way of describing what happened at the fall when Adam and Eve disobeyed God. Once Adam and Eve had disobeyed, various punishments happened. There were some particular examples given in Genesis 3, pain in childbearing for the woman. The ground would be hard to work, and of course there would be death. But those were really just examples of all the kinds of suffering that now entered the world as nature was subjected to frustration. So diseases entered the world, famine entered the world, hurricanes, tsunamis, earthquakes. All of these came not directly as a result of individual human sin, like a war, for example, happens because of the sin of murder, but they're a result of the fall in that they're God's punishment for our rejection of him. Who caused this? Well, I've kind of just given the answer away, but let's see what it says in the passage. It says that this didn't happen by its own choice. That makes sense, doesn't it? and ground doesn't decide to have an earthquake and volcanoes don't decide to erupt. No, it happened by the choice, the will of the one who subjected it, by God himself. He subjected it in hope, and we'll get to that at the end of our time together, but he subjected it to this frustration nonetheless. He created a world where suffering could now exist as a result of human sinfulness. Now, that's a general principle, but there are many examples of specifics throughout the Bible. So, for example, I've been reading Job in my quiet times recently. In Job 12, it says this: "To God belong wisdom and power, counsel and understanding are his. If he holds back the waters, there is drought. If he lets them loose, they devastate the land." Job says both floods that destroy life and droughts that destroy life come from God as a response to human sin. So the source of suffering in the world is in one sense God, but ultimately it's humans, because God is punishing humans by subjecting the creation to frustration. It's a consequence of human sin, a punishment for human sin. Now that presents a big problem, because so often suffering isn't there. And that's where we pick up Psalm 73, which Peter read for us before. I turn back there if you can. The psalmist describes a time where he nearly lost his faith in God. Why was that? Well, he says in verse 3, "For I envied the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." He looked at those people who'd rejected God, who'd rejected his ways, and they lived in prosperity. They were wealthy. Hang on, if God's subjected the world to frustration, why aren't these evil people being punished? He carries on in verse 5. "They are free from common human burdens. They are not plagued by human ills." As he looked on them, he saw that whilst everyone else was getting ill, they weren't. They seem to have escaped from all human pain. Why aren't they getting some life-threatening disease? And then he looks at himself. Now, he doesn't claim to be perfect, but he's trying to obey God's law, no doubt keeping the sacrifices that atone for his sin. And yet, what's happening to him? Verse 13, "Surely in vain I have kept my heart pure and have washed my hands in innocence. All day long I have been afflicted, and every morning brings new punishments." He's saying, "And look, and there's these evil people, and they're having a wonderful life, and here am I trying to live a God-honoring life, and my life is terrible. If God is in control of suffering, why is it not being meted out fairly?" I'm sure you struggled with that at some point in your own life as well. You see a Christian family going through an immense time of suffering, you'd think, why then? You often hear about, in biographies of Victorian missionaries, how the whole family would get off in a boat, they'd go and visit this island where no one had ever heard the name of Jesus. And within a month, all of the family, except for the father, are dead, having died of malaria. And you think, why is God allowing that to happen? Or I know of a church that was planted in Liverpool about a decade or so ago. And not long after they planted, their young pastor died of cancer. What's God doing in that situation? And at the same time, evil murderers and false teachers die in peace, never having a day of trouble, it seems, in their life. How is that fair? What is God doing? Now, that's a problem that only really exists if God is sovereign. But it's noteworthy that it's a problem the Bible addresses all the time. I read to you Psalm 73. We could have gone to Job. We could have gone to Habakkuk. We could have gone to Ecclesiastes, 1 Peter, Revelation. And those are just the big books that discuss the issue. You could go through the minutiae, and pretty much every book has a chapter addressing this problem. The Bible brings us face to face with it. It says that there's suffering in the world that often doesn't make sense. It's not doled out according to how good or how bad a person is. There's suffering in the world. So we might wonder, what's God's purpose? Sometimes his purpose is to punish human sin. There is suffering in the world for that reason. But what about in the individual cases? What is God doing? Well, let's look now at the purpose of our suffering. And if you flick to John chapter 9, we're going to look at a very famous example of God using suffering. We said before in this series that saying what God's purpose is always a bit of a difficult thing to say, because God is so great. He has a billion purposes in a leaf falling off a tree. You know, he knows the consequences of everything. But behind all of the different purposes God has, there is an ultimate purpose. And we're going to see that as we look through some of these passages. So, John chapter 9. As he, that's Jesus, went along, he saw a man blind from birth. So he's blind from birth. He's not become blind later in his life. He wasn't blinded. He was born without the capacity for sight. Verse 2. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents, that he was born blind?" So you can see their dilemma here. The disciples assume that if somebody is blind, it must be a result of their sin. And that was the common view in the day. Whenever something bad happened to you, it must have been because you did something bad. But in this situation, who's done the bad? Did this little child do some sin in the womb that caused them to be blinded before they were even born? Or was it that their parents sinned and the punishment fell upon the child? Which is it? The disciples haven't even considered the possibility that it could be neither. They're assuming that's the case. But Jesus says, neither this man nor his parents sinned. Now, Jesus isn't saying these are perfect people in the sense that he's perfect. He's saying they aren't being punished for particular sins. But this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. Jesus says that not all suffering is a direct punishment of God on particular sins. It is a general punishment on general human sin that these things exist. And that answers Asaph the psalmist. But in the same way, sufferings happen to individuals for a greater purpose, for the work of God to be displayed. Through this man and his subsequent healing by Jesus, God is able to display how passionate, compassionate he is, how loving he is, how caring he is. And that fits into what we learned in earlier weeks. We saw that God does everything to the praise of his glorious grace. And so everything that happens in the universe ultimately climaxes in us seeing what kind of a God he is. And individual cases of suffering fit into that. This man was born blind so that he could be healed, so that God's work could be displayed. Something similar is said in John chapter 11, if you want to turn over the page or however far it is. In John chapter 11, Jesus is told that Lazarus is sick, and Jesus decides not to go. And verse 4, it says, when he heard this, Jesus said, "This illness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Lazarus is permitted to go through a time of illness, to die, so that God might be glorified through what Jesus is going to do by raising him from the dead. Now, you might think, well, that's all well and good. We know Lazarus and the man born blind, they had particular roles in Jesus' life. He had to do miracles. But what about the general, ordinary, everyday suffering of every person in this congregation? Well, there's a famous verse in Romans, shortly after the bit that we read before. Romans 8:28 tells us, "And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose." So in all things, he works for good. That doesn't mean everything's good for people that follow Jesus. No, it means even in suffering, even in the hardest times, God is working for a good purpose. We might see the glory of God. Now, I say these things with a bit of trepidation because some of those verses have been used to beat people over the head with. And that's why we had to start this by looking at Psalm 73. That psalm is a psalm for public worship. God wants us to express our pain at the injustice in the world. even if we eventually push through it. And as we've seen, as we've read a psalm at the beginning of every service for ages now, we see that time and time again, God created songs and prayers in the book of Psalms that express to God, I don't know what you're doing here. I'm struggling. Because he knows that we will be in pain as we go through human suffering. Never does God want those verses to be used to beat people up and say, look, just get over it. God's using it for his glory. It's no big deal. Now, God always acknowledges human pain and the depths of it. But he wants us to know that even in the midst of those deepest trials, he's using them for good. Nat and I were once walking in the Brecon Beacons before the kids were born, and we came across a sheep that was stuck in a hedge. We didn't want to go past and leave it there because we didn't know when a shepherd might go past. It was out of the field. It was really in a bad way. And so what I did was I tried to wrestle it out of the tree. And the sheep was not happy with me doing that, let me tell you. It was writhing, it was bleating, it was trying to kick me. But eventually, I got it out of the tree. It didn't thank me. It ran away, screaming its head off, because it was convinced that I was there to cause it harm. But in the end, it was better for that sheep to go through the pain of me tugging it and dragging it out of its suffering than to let it be stuck there for hours. And that's what it's often like with us. That sheep didn't have the capacity to understand what I was doing in that situation. But the gap between us and God is so much greater than the gap between me and that sheep. We can't always see what God is doing in our suffering. But we do know he's always working for good. We have one advantage over the sheep. We know the one who helps us. And maybe if I had actually been the shepherd that had reared that sheep from the time that it was born, maybe it would have trusted me. Maybe it would have known that I was doing something for its benefit. It might not have known why I was doing it or what I was doing, but it would have known that the shepherd always does what is good. That's the way we can look at God. We might not understand the particular instances of suffering and why those things have to happen. But we do know the one who's in control. And we can know that in every instance of suffering, he is working for our ultimate goods. So these verses aren't a call to get over it and suffer for God without complaining. They're a message from our loving shepherd saying, I know what you're going through right now. I'm sorry that you're going through this, but I promise you, I'm using it for your good. As one author has put it, when we pray to God, God will either give us what we ask for or give us what we would have asked for if we knew everything that he knows. That is the case in every situation. And that's the most important thing to say about God's suffering. But I feel that it's important to mention two other things which are a massive part of the Bible's teaching on suffering, even if they're maybe a bit tangential to the issue of suffering. The first is, which is our fourth point, sorry, that's very confusing, the sympathiser of our sufferings. Again, if you want to flick with me, Hebrews chapter 5, verses 7 to 10, and we read here that God didn't just stay distant from our sufferings. He came down as a man and suffered human sufferings. In all of its intensity, listen to Hebrews 5, 7 to 10. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Son though he was, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him, and was designated by God to be high priest in the order of Melchizedek. What was it like for Jesus on earth? Did he just bounce through saying, I know God's got it in hand? No. He offered up prayers and petitions. He prayed with fervent cries and tears. We don't hear that Jesus was someone immune from suffering, like some Superman. No. He knew what it was to go through suffering. He knew what it was to weep, to cry, to pray. We're told that he learned obedience through what he suffered. Now, that's not because he was disobedient previously. But as God, he never had to obey anyone because he just always did what he wanted to do. But as God in human flesh, he had to learn what obedience looked like. He had to learn what it was to suffer because God had called you to suffer. And so that means he learnt obedience, not in the sense that he learnt what good and bad were, but he learnt what it was to be an obedient person in the midst of suffering. In heaven, he had never suffered one moment of eternity, but having become a man, he learnt what you and I go through every day. He learnt what it was to suffer. And through this, Jesus became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. Through this suffering, he brought salvation. And so ultimately, that suffering which he went through was for good. So Jesus has gone through exactly what we go through. He's had to obey God's commands in its suffering, but for the ultimate good that comes at the end. And that makes him a sympathetic high priest to anyone who comes to him. He knows what it is to grieve. He knows what it is to be in pain. He knows what it is to be rejected. He knows what it is to see someone you love damaging themselves. He knows what it is to pray with tears before God. Some of you are going through suffering in this room that I don't understand, and maybe no one else in this room understands. But Jesus knows. And he sets us the great example of reverent submission. He trusted God's sovereign will on the cross, saying, "Not my will, but yours be done." We're saved by trusting in his faithfulness to God. And we're also set the example by him of what we're to do. So we've seen the source of our suffering, the problem of our suffering, the purpose of our suffering, the sympathizer of our suffering. And then finally, we see the end of our suffering. Flick to Revelation chapter 21, verses 1 to 4. As you flick there, let me give you a big picture of where we're up to in the book of Revelation. Revelation often gets this reputation as a bit of a spooky book, like nobody knows what to do with it. But Revelation is basically a book about God's sovereignty. It says to a persecuted church, you're going to go through all sorts of suffering, but eventually Jesus is going to come back. And all through those sufferings, he's on the throne, he is in charge, he knows what's going on. Then we get to the ultimate end of that suffering in verses 1 to 4, chapter 21. John says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.'" You see what God's sovereign plan is aiming for? When he says all things are working for good, what does he mean? He doesn't mean you'll look back in 2 years and think, "I'm glad I went through that," because that isn't always the case. He's working towards this. And this is the thing that will make all of our suffering worth it. A new heaven and a new earth. That's required because both heaven and earth are stained currently. Okay, earth is stained by human sin. Heaven is stained by demonic sin in that there are angels that fell away. But this is a new heaven and a new earth, a world without sin anywhere in its purview. And there's no longer any sea. Everyone always thinks that's a really weird thing to say, but the sea was dangerous. John knew that. He was a fisherman. Twice in the Gospels, they nearly died in the middle of a storm. He knows what the sea can do. The sea is a picture of nature that has been subjected to frustration. And now it is tamed. It's gone. No more will ships sink at sea. No more will there be storms tossing the waves of life. And just like we said in Genesis 3, that the examples given are just an example of the whole of creation, well, so it is here. Just as there's no longer a sea for storms, there will no longer be famine. There will no longer be disease. There will no longer be any imperfections in all of creation, because human sin has been paid for. God dwells with his people, and the result of this, amongst many blessings, is the end of human suffering. Every tear will be wiped from our eyes. There won't be any death anymore. There won't be any mourning over lost loved ones. There won't be crying or pain for any other purpose. The old order of things, where humans had to suffer as a consequence of sin, that will have passed away. And the new has come. So let's draw to an end what we've learned. First, we've learned the source of human suffering. Suffering is sent by God on the world as a punishment for human rebellion against him. He isn't doing this because he enjoys to see people suffer. He's ordaining it as a just judgment for human sin. Secondly, we learn the problem of suffering. There's a big problem for Christians because sometimes it seems suffering isn't fair, that the wrong people are being punished. Thirdly, we learn the purpose of human suffering. God is using suffering for his glory and our ultimate good. That doesn't mean that we'll know in every situation what God is doing. It doesn't mean that we have a perfect trouble-free life. It certainly doesn't mean we can rebuke those who are suffering and say, chin up. But it helps us know the character of the one who is leading us through suffering and what he is using it for. Fourthly, we learn about the sympathize of our suffering, that Jesus knows what it is to suffer. We never need to think God is distant from us. We never need to think that he doesn't know what we've gone through, because Jesus, God in human flesh, has suffered and been tempted in every way, yet without sin. And finally, we learnt the end of suffering, that this world isn't all there is, that it isn't suffering after suffering after suffering. No, God will bring a conclusion to this sinful world. He will wipe every tear from our eyes and give us a suffering-free eternity, beholding the glory of the Lord Jesus Christ.